This is Mike Skidmore, recorded by Chris Eldon Lee at the Bass Club Reunion, Cardiff, on the 11th of June 2010. Mike Skidmore.
My name's Mike Skidmore. I was born in Wolverhampton on the 30th of May 1943.
And what was your first brush with the Antarctic? When were you first aware of it?
When I was first aware of it, back in the school days in 1957-58, I was quite keen on geography, and one of the aspects of geography, I suppose, would be knowledge of the world and the world about us, and I was obviously keen on knowing where things were and what was happening to the world. And it so happened at the time that the Fuchs's Transantarctic expedition was in place, it had been set up, and they were about to set off across to transverse of the Antarctic from Shackleton Base to Scott Base at McMurdo Sound. And what got me really was the fact that every morning on the 8 o'clock news there was a bulletin about their progress, and I think that just inspired me really to think in polar regions. And from that day, I suppose, I always thought, well, yes, that's something unique and something you'd like to do. And I suppose following on from that, when I was at university, we were discussing towards the end, in our final year, you know, ambitions. And somebody would say something, and when it came round to me, I said, I think they'd like to go to the South Pole. And little did I believe that I nearly got there. But how it came about, I suppose, was there was a recruitment drive coming round to the universities, and they asked anybody interested. They're looking for geologists, for electrical engineers, they're looking for surveyors, they're looking for all forms of scientific staff. And I went along to the meeting, and I think as a result I probably picked up the application form and sent them off, and in due course I was called for interview.
You were doing geology at university?
I started off doing engineering, but I found the natural world a little bit more sort of to my interest, and I eventually swapped from doing engineering to geology.
So had geology been a hobby of sorts?
No, I think I'd been inspired really some years previously when on holiday. I was fascinated by this guy on the beach somewhere. I think it was Weymouth, but I'm not at all certain. He was knocking open pebbles and splitting them open, and he's finding crystals inside. Little did I know that they were geodes. But the main thing was that fascinated me. I remember going home and finding all the pebbles in the garden and smashing them open and not finding a similar. And I think from then on, I had that interest in the natural world and the processes thereof. I had the interest in geography. And this is what brought about my interest in actually going down to the Antarctic. And, of course, by applying to British Antarctic Survey, it was a stepping stone on the way to this ambition to the South Pole.
So the milk round, as it used to be called, the university,
yeah.
That was the first suggestion in your mind that you might actually even get anywhere near the South Pole.
I suppose so, yes. I think so. I think that was the first indication that it might be possible. Little did I know that other people from other backgrounds could also apply, but this was the notice on the wall in the department notice board, looking for earth scientists or geologists in those days to apply.
We're talking here about the mid 60s, aren't we?
This would be in 66, early 66. Yes.
What was the interview like? Do you remember it?
I know there were two people I can remember in the interview, because it was an interview for Geological Post. There was Bill Sloman, and there was Ray Ady, and there was somebody else, and I don't really know who that was.
Nobody seems to be able to remember the third person.
And I seem to think it was an interview more about character and interests rather than accent on geology. And little did I know that, you know, that not only were they interested in somebody who could do a bit of geology, but somebody would fit in, I suppose. So you were being
assessed out psychologically, were you?
Well, the people who I put down on as references were sort of staggered by the amount of information which those references demanded. I never knew what they actually did demand, but I was told later they were extraordinarily extensive. And that was how it was done in those days.
So by the time you got to the interview, do you think it was more or less a foregone conclusion?
Well, I think I had the interview, then the references went out.
Oh, I see.
I think, because they were so demanding. And then I heard later that provided I got a degree, you know, I was on board. As it happened, I just got the drinker's degree, which was good enough. I went along to the prof and says, look, this says, provided I get a degree, does that mean any degree?
So a 2-2 was okay.
So a 2-2 was fine, yes. They would accept somebody with a third, actually, provided they got a degree.
So what happened next? Was there an extensive training?
No. What happened next was, having got my degree, of course, I sent a letter to the British Antarctic Survey and said, yep, I've got the degree. And they wrote a letter back saying, on turn up at Birmingham University Department of Geology on a certain such a date, and you'll be, you know, signed on and so on, which I duly did. This is about probably the middle of July or the beginning of the end of the first week in July. And from that day until I left, we were immersed in geological matters with all the other geologists who had just come back, like Louis Jukes. And there's another guy called Mike Fleet who were working in that department, because the Department of Geology at Birmingham University in 1966 was the base of the geology section of British Antarctic Survey. And so one got to know a few of the old lags, so to speak, those that had come back. And we were there from July, August, September, and finally I sailed early October. But prior to that, there was a meeting in Cambridge where everybody was assembled and you were given tea and cakes at Sir Vivian Fook's house, and the press came round and interviewed everybody. But it was a general amalgamation of all the people that were going to go south that year, and I suppose there must have been 30 or 40 of them.
Were you given things such as crevasse rescue training and health and safety training?
No, I don't think... There was nothing like that. We all thought, well, we should have crevasse rescue training, health and safety interrupted activities. In those days, we were just signed on, and you would probably pick it up on the way as regards things like that. No, I don't think I saw a crevasse until I got there.
And were you briefed about the geology you were expected to do?
Well, yes, but the work I was expected to do never actually took place for a long time. I was sent to Halley.
Do you know why?
It might have been because, you know, I probably fit in better with the other people there. Mm-hmm. That's the only reason I can think of. Because I found I got on well with the people there. I didn't get on so well with the people who went to other bases. So I think they assessed one's character as being able to fit in probably better with that particular environment than others going to other bases, particularly down the Antarctic Peninsula. I've always wondered about that, and I can only think that was the case.
Not really relevant only to you, but was Halley regarded as slightly second rate compared to working on the west coast of the peninsula? Was it a less popular?
I've never thought of it in that way. The fact that it was base Z, where all the others were A, B, C, D, and E, etc., may have brought something into it, but I don't think so. I never regarded it like that in any light at all.
Okay, when you got there, of course, things were different, weren't they?
When I got there, well, on the way, of course, I did a couple of months geology on South Georgia, and indeed, on the way out, I did some more work on South Georgia. But to consider the time I spent at Halley, I was about the only geologist who spent 18 months not touching a rock.
So what went wrong?
Well, the field season, which would be 67-68, we were scheduled to go through the Thiron Mountains, across the Slesser Glacier, to the Shackleton Range. That was the plan. And that plan unfolded, and we did go. We went off, but we never got there. We were diverted further and further away because of the incredible crevasse nature of the Slesser Glacier. Now, without a map, it's a bit tricky to describe this. But we were pushed. It was, instead of going south, we were going northeast at one stage to try and get round the head of this glacier. We got probably to within about 3 days' journey, but that was only at the end of our normal supply line. Had we gone further forward from the furthest point we got, we might have set foot on it, but then we might have encountered difficulties. We might have brought about problems with, because we're at the end of the supply line. It was probably not the wisest thing to have done, were to push forward 4 days, then it's 4 days back on half rations or anything like that. There was no backup, and if you got into trouble, then it would have been, well, a case of who'd have thought it.
So you travelled, what, 600 miles to get there?
The journey there, we went south from Halley, across the Bob Pye Crossing, which you've probably been told about. We went down through the Thirons. We went from the Thirons, a reconnaissance party set out to go directly to the Shackletons, but got deviated all the time and eventually was diverted well away. And the tractor party, with all the supplies, had to find a safe route. And so this advance party, the reconnaissance, we had to then follow them, really. So the dogs ahead of the keg party. But at a certain point, you know, they couldn't go further forward. They would have to dump the supplies wherever they got to at a certain date to get back to relieve the ship, because the vehicles, the muskegs, were required then. We would then be left on our own, just two dog teams, and we realised we're at such a point that one dog team could go forward, another dog team could actually backtrack, but instead of going round two sides of a triangle to get back to Halley, they were going to cut across the third side, and they proved a route, I would say, probably two-thirds of the way back to... But then they had to come back to meet us. And at the furthest point that our sledging party got to, and I was with it because I was the geologist and the rocks were the general idea, we reckon we're just about 600 miles... sledging to get back to base. And I seem to recall that something like the 12th or 13th of January we turned round to return home, and we arrived back at sort of the end of the first week in March. I can't remember the exact dates. I mean, I've got them in a diary. And that was my geological field excursion that year. So really, I was a bit cheesed off without having no work. I was in a professional environment. I had nothing apart from the work on South Georgia to offer, and I was not very happy. I was not a happy bunny. And on base, I realised that there's nothing could be done about it. And I think, as a consequence, I applied to say, look, can I be transferred down the peninsula? The likelihood of finding rock down there is a bit better. But in the meantime, the office in London and Sir Vivian Fuchs and so on made arrangements with the National Science Foundation of America to join a party which they were flying in from Christchurch, McMurdo, a party of Norwegians to the Norwegian sector of the Vestfjellet or the Heimfrontfjellet, where Tony Baker went to, who you spoke to earlier. When he was there on his first trip. So the plan was they were going to fly both parties in, drop one off in the Vestfjellet, which is the Norwegian name for that particular sector, fly to Halley, pick us up, fly us into the shacks, drop us off, then fly back. And it via the South Pole. And we were within an ace of not being dropped off in the shacks.
Because
the ground was obscured by cloud. And if you have cloud and the pilot cannot see any ground relief, he daren't make a landing, especially with the Hercules. And he would have flown onto the South Pole, where he knew if he could land in fog or whatever, because he landed there before. He was doing a once-time landing in the Shackletons. And the only place he could find was something like 20 miles south of the main range. That's the only bit of sunlight he found. And we went for it and we landed there. So we got there in the end, and I nearly got to the South Pole.
But at the same time.
The
decision on the first attempt to return back, elaborate on that. Was there some argument? Was it heartbreaking? You were so close yet so far.
I was with Pete Noble. Now, Pete Noble's written a book. I don't know whether you've read it. It's called Dog Days on Ice. And it's the first part of it involves the story of him and me starting off at virtually our furthest point and sort of backtracking, but diverging to various other aspects on the way. So I recommend you read that. No, there was no question of going anywhere out of, where you shouldn't really. The party we were with, Peter and myself, we were with a dog team called the Hairy Breeks. And our job, basically, was to find a route in, a route that could be a sustained vehicle. And so we probed further this head of this glacier. And I think we had to turn back and backtrack a couple of times before we finally made it. And we could actually see, in the distance, nunataks in the blue haze. And we tried to estimate where we were. I suppose it's probably 3 or 4 days. We had done dead reckoning from a known spot and plotted it on the map, and I don't know whether we may have been within 10 miles of that place. I don't know. But there was no question of risking lives and limb by going forward, because there was other people involved in the party, as well as because there was John Galsworthy and Nick Mathis. The other sledge party were a dog team called the Mobsters, and they were backtracking away back to Halley across country, so to speak. And they only did that job when we started our return journey, so we're never more than about 100 miles apart. If anything had befallen either of us, then we would never more than about 100 miles or 2 or 3 days' journey.
So it wasn't health and safety that drove you back, it was common sense.
It's common sense, yes, yes. And there have been instances where people said, well, let's dump this, let's dump that, and let's go for it. And done it, got away with it, come back, and then told people later. But if anything had happened, a case of who'd have thought it'd be.
Before the second attempt with the Americans, tell me how you spent your time at Halley. What were you doing? Did they follow each other quite smartly, or was there a gap?
When I returned on this first trip, there was no geological work to do. Although on the way back, we had a bit of a holiday in the Theorons, and I'd actually tapped my hammer on a rock. But the thing is, it's already been done by Dave Brook, who had been there two seasons before. And that was his field area. All I could do really was have a look at it. And just sort of, from a geological point of view, just sort of sit on a rock and say, well, here I am. but it wasn't my work area. So I think I picked up a few samples and brought them back with me, but that was about it. When I got back to base, of course, I've been involved in the building of Halley 2, which is known as Grillage Village. When we arrived in 67, we were building a new base about two miles inland from the old base. And it was laid out in such a way that there was a lot of grillage on the ground to spread the weight of the buildings that were put up on them. And the term Grillage Village has stuck. But it was the second Halley base. And in the first season, I found myself really a bit of a spare part. I did the cooks, I did that, I did this. I went out with the glaciologists. And then I finally found myself involved with field preparations for the season we actually went out in 67 to 68. And when we got back, course, I had no work to do, so I was more or less a spare tool, a spare hand, and I involved myself with all the other work of completing the building, the base, primarily the geology office. And so I did learn a lot of carpentry skills, particularly from... Well, at one point, I said to the base me, can I just have a job rather than sort of turn up every day like a docker and wait to be allocated a job? Mm. I said, can I do something? And he set me on with a guy called Bob Docker, Geordie Docker, who was taken down as a carpenter. And I learnt a lot from him of basic joinery. And that stood me quite well in ever since. So when I got back from this big field trip, there was build up the office and paint it. In fact, I found myself doing quite a bit of painting, you know, putting up ceiling tiles and all sorts of little jobs.
How did Bass HQ feel about a geologist spending a year not doing geology?
Well, I think it was one of those things that they just had to, it just happened.
Had to swallow it.
You know, it's like okay, there's an aeroplane. They go and crash it. So it just changed the whole program. It's one of those things. I just happened to be at the blunt end of it, and I enjoyed my time there, but I didn't do any geology until we heard that we were going to be flown in with the Americans in a Herky Bird to the Shackletons,
what happened when you got there?
Well, we landed and we were about 20 miles south of the main area. Clearly, we couldn't work from there, so we spent the first week sledging in everything much closer into the mountains.
They landed dogs with you, did they?
We took 27 dogs, 3 sledges, 6 men, food, all the supplies needed to establish us for about 10 weeks. And then I think they put an extra drum of AVTA on in case of problems and so on. And the amazing thing was when we tried to take off from Halley. You know, it was one of these, the Hercules, the C-130F, they used to have JATO bottles, which they had attached to the side of the fuselage to give it a bit of a boost to get it, to bounce it in. Because it used to go along the ground and the bounce... bouncy, bouncy, and then it would gain more airspeed, land and more airspeed. And at a certain point, the pilot would pull the switches, and once he got sufficient airspeed, it was hoped that the JATO would just give him that bit more punch to get him into the sky. It didn't work. We went on, and I seem to remember somebody said... if they keep going in the direction we're going, we're going up in the gin bottle, which is an area of ice disturbance about 4 or 5 miles from base, because that was the prevailing wind was coming from that direction. Finally, we staggered into the air, circled base once, and we're off. But I think we were given all up weight of about £10,000. And
scary moment? Were you worried?
We still had plenty of time to stop, but, you know, it kept going. I presume he'd done it before and he knew that. But the boost that these bottles gave sort of ran out.
So anyway, here you are in the Shackletons.
Here we are in the Shackletons. The first thing that happened, I fell ill because obviously I'd been on base for some time and there were two people coming in from the outside world. One was Ken Blakelock, who's a well-known, well-respected surveyor. And he had another surveyor with him called Tony True. And they came in, and I hadn't been there on the ground more than perhaps a day, but I just felt absolutely awful. So did Ken Blakelock, and I think he'd picked something up on the way from, and I'd got it as well, probably from the crew on the aircraft. The funny thing about that is they didn't know where they were when they flew out from the Americans flew. It was always regarded as a sort of a mission, so only the pilot knew where they were going. And when they landed in the Vestfjella, they dropped the Norwegians off, they landed at Halley, they wondered where the earth they were. And we said, oh, you're at Halley Bay. Well, of course, you know, they haven't got much idea of where it was, what time of the day it was or anything. But anyway, I was distinctly not very well for about 3 or 4 days. And during this period, me and Ken Blakelock were sort of billeted in the same tent. The others were running in and out, shuttling back all the supplies about 8 or 10 or 12 miles nearer the Shackletons to establish a permanent base. And finally, I sort of picked up and went in with them. So I think my first few days there was, I was pretty grim. I remember feeling quite lousy. But it picked up and I was all right since. And then Peter Clarkson. Have you interviewed Peter?
No, but I gather he's coming this weekend.
Right. Well, he was the geologist who came in when Dave Brooke went out. And so he was the geologist who I accompanied, or we went into the Shackletons together. So we had one sledge. The surveyors had each had a general assistant, and they had the other two sledges. And their idea was to put in ground control for the trimetrical photography, which had been flown some years previously. Mm. Meanwhile, at the same time, I must say this, a party from base with Pete Noble as leader, with Alan Etchells and John Galswell and a couple of other people, that actually drove to the Shackletons by the route which we'd proved the previous season. And they spent about 3 weeks actually in the shacks, in the eastern end of the shacks, collected what they could of the rocks, and then they had to return for the ship. So, in fact, that trip we made the previous season, 67-68, was used. But really, it was really unviable to operate such a long range from Halley under the circumstances.
They were using muskegs?
They were using muskegs and international BD-8s.
Yeah.
In the event, the fuel consumption figures meant that we towed the muskegs on sledges pulled by the little BD-8 bulldozers, and they did the main journey. We then drop off the BD-8s and then go on in the muskegs, and they built a caboose on a sledge which they all slept in, which has got is quite famous. So they were in the eastern Shackletons, we were in the western Shackletons, and the idea was to confirm the geology which had been first looked at by the geologists with the Transantarctic expedition only about 10 years before. And the idea was just to confirm it, extend it. A term we would use as sort of reconnaissance geology, I think, would be the way we would do it. Just go along, see what's there, make a few measurements, move on, see what's there. Any further interpretation, any detailed work would have to wait until another occasion. We had about, as it turned out, about eight weeks on which we to go the western Shackletons and the central area of the Shackletons. Meanwhile, the surveyors were running around doing all the surveying. There was Ken Blakelock, Tony True, Nick Mathis and Harry Wiggins. Now, there's a story there.
Go on.
I don't know which one you want to hear first, but
both of them.
Oh, right. After about 10 days, we had the alarming news that Nick Mathis had broken his leg. It was a Potts fracture. He broke it skiing. So that made things rather difficult. And they had to get him back to base. We all had to go back to base. And we all had some plaster of Paris bandages. And we were able to set his leg under the direction of Murray Roberts,
yeah.
Has he mentioned this?
Yes, briefly, yeah. Yes. And well, the base you're talking about is not Halley Base, but the base you made at
the base we made in the shacks, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I've forgotten whether it had a proper name, I don't know, but basically that was it.
No, carry on with the story, please.
We all returned there. We set Nick's leg, and very stoically, he then spent the next 6 weeks more or less sat in the tent, looking after himself, or somebody might have been with him at times, making sure his leg got better. And I understand, but by the time we were flown out in the middle of January, they did X-ray his leg, and it was healing up quite nicely. There was no further need for any treatments. So
Murray Roberts says it took him absolutely ages to get the plaster cast off. It was so thick.
It was a good one. I don't. Anyway, that's Nick's story. That meant the surveyors had to work by themselves. So each man with a Ken Blakelock and a dog team, Harry Wiggins with a dog team. Tony True went out occasionally, but they'd had to complete the work by themselves. So it was a case of sledging round by yourself, not two people like Pete and myself. And they achieved and succeeded in doing it.
Tell me about the geology you found, and what did you find, and were there any surprises?
The geology... Oh, dear. I must confess that when I first got I got to a rock, I mean, it was the horror of all geology. I sat on it. I haven't got a clue what this is. You know, because I hadn't seen that one before. But, you know, when you get exposure, it's 100%. You know, it doesn't come up with dirt or anything. And eventually, you know, we were able to determine it was hornblende schist or something like that. I really must confess that I've forgotten much of it now. But we were able to work round what we knew, add to what there was, make a collection for every station, and then proceed to other areas which had been seen from a distance and that hadn't been visited on previous occasions. But it's very alarming when you spent all this time wondering, you know, get the shackles, and your first bit of rock you pick up, you think, crumbs, what on earth? It's embarrassing as well. But anyway, that's the story. We did find some nice crystals, and I must confess that I got the odd bits at home. But by and large, I think the most interesting mineral we found is a mineral that's called fuchsite. That's nothing to do with Savilian fuchs. Okay. It's true. It's a greenish mica. And there was plenty of that associated on in the Mount Absalom area and the central part of the range.
But you were taking samples for analysis back in Birmingham.
Oh, well, we're taking samples. It was boxes and boxes. The idea, you know, you just bring samples back and... But as regards to work out the detailed sequences, it's not really not really the sort of thing we can do by just travelling round. You've got to spend the time there studying them. It's the other things we found there of interest. You know, there's the birds, the wildlife. There were Antarctic petrels nesting. All the not Antarctic petrel, what do they call them? Snowy petrel. I've forgotten the name of them.
Snow petrels,
not Antarctic. And in the Shackletons, which must be the nearest sea must be 250 miles away, and that would be the southern area of the Weddell Sea, you know, around where Shackleton Base was. And the lichen would be growing on the rocks. It was amazing, you know, to find life at almost or virtually 80 degrees south. We were able to travel with the Harry Briggs dog team then. We would arrive at a location and split up. And Pete would go up that mountain and I'd go up that hill. And then we had 3 or 4 hours and then we'd come back and move on. So a day's work would be sledging, stop, pick up the dogs. We'd choose a different... We generally didn't work on the same bit, you know, because we were there gathering information. And I remember on one occasion I suggested, well, I'll go up that one and you go over there. And it took him hours to walk to his... Didn't realise that, you know, the distances are so... difficult to determine. I was about 20 minutes, I was on my rocks popping, and he was still walking to it. You just couldn't tell how far these things were away. So, you know, and that was the one that was eventually, I understand, called Mount Skidmore. Yes, I was privileged to be given the name of a mountain on which I believe I'd actually walked. But I've got pictures of it, but I found subsequently on the net, you know, there was a party from Exeter University were actually working on Mount, or they had their base camp near Mount Skidmore on the north side of the Shackleton Range overlooking the Slessor Glacier. But that's
was that recently?
Yeah, a couple of years ago. Yeah.
Have you had any contact with him?
I have had contact. I got him to send me pictures of Mount Skidmore, but they really weren't what I would have hoped for, I'm afraid.
When did you find out you had a mountain named after you? Because did you know straight away?
Oh, no. I can't remember how it happened. The Place Names Committee met something like 1972, and they allocate a whole lot of mountain names to all the people who'd worked in them. There's Clarks and Cliffs. The people that did the Traverse in the Muskegs, they've all got names. The guys we were with, they've got names. All got names of minor features. So, yes, I was quite pleased to be given a name.
But were you told, or did you just discover
it? I think I just discovered it, you know, yeah. The process. Here's a map, and you got your name on it. That's as much ceremony as I think there was about it. I think it was Pete Clarkson actually sort of provided me with that. The paper on which the Mount Skidmore's name was placed.
Whilst we're talking about geology, you also did some work on South Georgia on your way down to and back from.
Yes, the I sailed on the Shackleton. The Shackleton dropped me off on South Georgia in about the end of October, I suppose. I then spent a couple of months at Stromness, staying in the manager's house. But whether that was the one that Shackleton ended up in or not, I really don't know. But that's the one it's credited with. There is some discussion that there was another manager's house at the time. But it's very, very comfortable. We took the lid off the chimney. We got the fire going, plenty of coal in the backyard. We got the hoses from the fire hydrants, and we managed to run in fresh water down the fire hoses. We just put them in a stream further up away from where all the sea elephants were, and then we had fresh water. And we operated from this base at Stromness to about the beginning of January, for just about 6 weeks. I didn't stray very far, but what I did do, we went over to Fortuna Bay and... This is when Shackleton did his trek in 1916. He got to a certain point on Breakwind Ridge, and he said to his fellas, he says, "What time is it?" They said, "Oh, 7 o'clock," and they could hear the whistle from the whaling station. They knew they were within range of human life. And then they took them about another 12 hours to actually descend, cross the glacier, cross the mouth of Fortuna Bay, crossing the glacial outwash stream, then come up the other side, down the little waterfall, which they had to, I don't know, we never actually found the waterfall. If there was, it must have been much bigger in those days. But that last trek, I suppose, was for them, you know, it was sort of a miracle. We found it quite hard as well to do it. And we camped for a few days. It was New Year's Day. I remember it was New Year's Day on overlooking Fortuna Bay. Did some field work there. Strayed onto Fortuna Glacier. But in those days, you didn't have problems with fur seals. Hmm. Nowadays, you can hardly move. And it was quite a rarity to see one. This is 1966. 1967. So that was the first experience, and on the way out, the Pearl of Dan dropped Pete Noble and myself off at Prince Olaf Harbour whaling station. Well, that was totally derelict, so we used our sledging tents, and we lived in that for two or three months until we were picked up by the John Biscoe in early April. And then we came home. So that was the geology then, was more detailed field work, which led to my getting an MSc out of it, and a published paper for the British Antarctic Survey Scientific Reports, which I think it was number 72, I can't remember, but that's the sort of...
A slightly left-field question, but why was it so important to know what the rocks are made of? Why do the geology in the first place?
Well, I think it's just a search for knowledge, isn't it? In my world, it was sort of fairly academic. But understanding how the various lithologies have been laid down and the processes leads to understanding of the evolution of the world. In those days, plate tectonics hadn't yet been proven, or they were in the process of being proven. And it was a new idea, and it was a transition phase between the traditional sort of approach to geology and this new evolution one, where we can prove that the continents have actually moved around. And understanding the process involved in causing these was part of understanding the Earth history. I mean, at the same time, the North Sea oil fields were being opened up. Mm. And understanding the processes involved in formation of structures and was an essential part of learning more about your world.
Did you find any fossils?
On South Georgia, I found about two.
In the Shackleton?
None.
Do you think there was also a political reason for all this, that in the game of chess that was going on at that time about who owned or who had the right to be in which bit of the Antarctic, if you'd done the geology, you had a greater claim? Did that strike you at the time?
No,
or subsequently?
No. I think it had been declared at an earlier stage that although there were territorial claims, they'd been set aside. I think there had been the Antarctic Treaty had been drawn up, which really... the nations had agreed not to pursue territorial gains, not to pursue activities which would be unreasonable in that environment, and for it to be maintained as a pristine environment. Subsequent to that, of course, all alien species have been removed. I mean,
except one,
yes. most people seem to think that should go as well, but then we wouldn't be there to evaluate the place.
Well, were you disappointed with the decision about dogs?
It was a long time after I'd
gone. A bit emotionally.
I think times move on. The skidoos, which have been running now reliably everywhere in the world, were just being introduced. Prior to that, we had a thing called the Eliasson snowmobile, or most people call it the Elsan, you know, after the toilets. It was the forerunner of the more sophisticated and possibly more reliable skidoo. And once you had skidoos, it meant that you didn't have to have dogs. And if it was reliable, you could, and radios, you could send people into the field. A dog has to be fed. A skidoo doesn't. But when you wake up in the morning and stick your head out of the door, the skidoo doesn't start barking and welcome to the world, whereas dogs do. So a lot of people have sentimental attachment to them, and I can well understand how that is the case. They have worked and been driven, and they've worked so hard as animals, as companions, and the whole of the original surveys of the British Antarctic Territory and has been achieved by the on the back of dogs, if you see what I mean. Not literally, but I mean by their
what about
their
dog pack. What about the famous muskegs? Were they the muskegs? Did they break your
well? There's always opinion? A case of discussions between dog drivers and keg drivers. And one of the jokes, I suppose, is that you can go into a bar and you'd either be going kegs, 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 and the other going dogs, dogs, dogs. The talk would be mutually amusing. But you didn't... with kegs, if you were a mechanic and you were confident in your work, then they could pull a lot more, but they could easily fall down a crevasse a lot easier. And in fact, that has happened. There has been people in the Heimfronts, a party, three were crushed in 1964, I think it was. So if they'd been driving dogs, they might not have been in the same position, and that's very sad. So they have their merits, but nowadays with skidoos and aircraft flying in, it's a total change in approach to the work, and it reflects on the sort of people that come to these reunions, I think. People who've been on a ship, they spent 2 years, the charisma of the whole thing is imbued in there, that sort of character. Whereas nowadays, they fly them into Stanley, they fly them into Rothera, they fly them into the field. They're looked after health and safety-wise by a general assistant. Gash hand is the term we use. They do their work, they then fly back to the base, they then fly back to Stanley, they fly back home. And what have they got? I mean, okay, they've been to the Antarctic, but it's they haven't got the sort of gut sort of feeling there. They're not like the Captain Scott and the Shackleton. They're those people who went out in those early days. I think we have more akin because we spent so much longer in that environment, living in that environment, working in that environment, and experiencing that environment than people have done today. You yourself have been down there, but it was a fleeting visit, wasn't it?
It was.
And
highlight of a lifetime.
Aye. My highlight, I suppose, might have been...
3 or 4 years of it.
Yeah. Well, 2 years of it, yeah.
So is that why... I mean, I noticed at these reunions that it's the old hands who come to the reunion, see, the more recent to FIDs.
Yes. If you were to plot a graph of age against... or date of attendance against years, you'd find there's always a peak around about the 60s and 70s. And then before then, of course, they aren't there because they're infirm. And after that, the way there are more people have been down, but they haven't... haven't got that intrinsic interest.
The investment.
In the investment they have. Because of the means of doing it, doing the work.
Do you think the threshold is the end of the heroic era, that you were towards the tail end of the heroic era?
Well, the heroic era,
The youngsters of today aren't being heroes anymore, really.
I don't like to call one heroes. The heroic era, in my view, finished with Shackleton.
Right.
The mechanical era... we're a product of using that, and I wouldn't like to categorise the doggy era, I think, if you want to to categorise it at all.
How when you were there in the Antarctic, just how great was the isolation? How much were you aware of what was happening in the rest of the world? Because you were there.
I'm not much of a newsy person, news hand. The news to us was what was going on base. We were there so isolated that you virtually lost interest. The Torrey Canyon disaster, that was 1966, I believe. Vietnam War was going on. And there was and then deception went up. And those are about the only three significant... Oh, yes, the World Cup was taking place... The year I left, that's when England won it. But I think what to us was news on base was what was going on amongst our community. You see, we had a community. The first year there were 39 people there. The second year there was something like 29. And whatever the news there was of interest to us was what was going on in our community. I mean, the penguins down at Emperor Bay. There would be which of the dogs are giving birth? You know, somebody's got toothache. That brings to another story. But overall, the news to us was what was going on in our little community and how it affected what we were doing. You tend to get very insular, I suppose. You tend to think the outside world is some distant part. The news, okay, you could listen to the radio, but I don't think many people did. Maybe the Met Men did on night duty, because they would produce a paper, a newspaper every Saturday, which summarises what was going on in the world. And it was called Penguinge. I don't know whether you've been told about this. Well, Penguinge...
This is different from Halley's Comet, is it?
Yes, it was a successor to it. Or that might have been called Phoenix. I can't remember. But basically, it was news of what was going on. They try and put down the football results and that sort of thing. I don't think I was able to contribute to it. I didn't have a journalistic flair. But I think it was a... When we printed it up, there was only 5 copies made. You couldn't do anything more. Yeah, that was 5 carbons, or that the top 4 carbons. So, yes.
Limited edition.
Limited edition, yeah, okay. Yes. I think I've got a couple at home.
When there were some... Actually, say there were nearly 40 men on the base at its peak on Halley.
Yeah.
When there are 40 men on a base, do they all seem to operate as one unit, or do subgroups appear?
Oh, you do tend to get little subgroups, but you tend to have the people that were studious, you tend to have the people that were always talking, garrulous. You tend to have those that like a drink now and again. You tend to get... There's one called the Black Gang. The Black Gang on base, okay, they get covered in oil. They're the diesel mechanic and the motor mechanics and so on. They would have... The office in the garage. There's the survey and geology. Well, we'd usually join them because they were part of the field. There was the Met staff, but by and large, with few exceptions, I think everybody seemed to get on well with everybody else. I think it all may depend on whether the base leaders is sort of. Perception of what was going on, and if there's difficulties, you know, sort of ironing them out beforehand. I do recall only one fisticuffs, and that was basically, I think, one guy who was so keen to do things, and somebody else got irritated by this keenness. It just came to blows for a brief encounter in the bar, perhaps after a few drinks, one night.
But frustrations were rare, were they?
I think I had frustrations. I mean, I look at my...
What about with each other?
Yeah, I'll tell you what I did. I was so frustrated, I built this model aeroplane. I had a Keelcraft kit. It was a model Auster. Now, the Auster was the reconnaissance aeroplane, which was taken down with the TAE. And for some reason, I don't know how, I had this Keelcraft kit. It was a balsa kit of a... an Auster. So I made it up and I painted it red, put BAS on it, and I flew it, you know, wound up the propeller, and I'd fly it in the lounge, and it flew. Now, it is recorded somewhere in the Penguins that this was a very successful ploy, because in voodoo, if you make an effigy of something you want to happen, it may work. Well, I made this aeroplane. And lo and behold, the thing had flown successfully, and it wasn't very long before we heard that an aeroplane had been... it had been arranged that we were going to fly into the Shackleton. So I think that was quite...
So it's not pure coincidence, then.
No. It was my balsa wood aeroplane, and so we flew to the Shackletons, and I said there's a few stories there, but
One of them is you actually had a fall, didn't you?
I had a fall. Yes, we were in the central Shackletons, in the Reed Mountains, And it was New Year's Eve. And the highest peak in the Reed Mountains, I believe, is called Mount Absalom, mm-hmm. who was named after some professor, I believe. And Pete Clarkson and myself had arrived at the foot of Mount Absalom, and there it was. That afternoon, we'd been up at a ridge, and I'd be working on a ridge on this occasion, probably working together. We descended, and being New Year's Eve, we felt it was appropriate to do something. So we decided we'd climb Mount Absalom. And I said, well, you know, there's two sides to here. We can either go up the face, which has got a snowfield at the top, and a scree, or if you go around the other side, off to the right it would be, it may be slightly more interesting route, but the ice field ended in ice cliffs, so we elected to go up the scree slope and then up the main snow slope to the top. And so we set off. We put rum in our cocoa, a couple of flasks of cocoa, packed our rucksacks, left the dogs well fed and picketed, and we set off on skis, and we skied across the snowfield to the bottom and then started up the scree slope. I suppose we probably didn't have more than perhaps 600 or 700 feet to go, basically, because, you know, we were good. And we left the scree field, and Pete was ahead, and we were just kicking steps. Now, we'd kicked steps previously in virtually every other snowfield, climbing up to get to things. But on this occasion, it wasn't so successful. Pete was ahead of me. We weren't roped up. Now, you may say, well, you should have put your crampons on and everything like that, but experience had shown that there was no real need. The slope probably wasn't more than, say, 30 degrees anyway. But on this occasion, it was soft snow on top of ice. And the kicking steps, you should have been able to go. And Pete, in fact, Pete was quite a way ahead, and I was following on. And then all of a sudden, I just sort of kicked into... I wasn't going in his steps because I was making my own. I just happened to be doing that. I suddenly found myself sliding down. I had ice axe, rucksack, and I began to slide and gathered speed, and there was this scree slope. Well, of course, it was better than ice cliffs around the corner. And the scree's probably no bigger than, a football or something that size. They weren't great big lumps, but they were sufficiently big enough that once I hit them with my feet, I was pitched forward and just rolled and rolled and rolled until I came to a stop. It was just like being inside a dustbin being beaten with baseball bats, that sort of sound. And I ended up, I remember I was face down, downhill, rucksack over my head. I think I was unconscious for just a few seconds. Meanwhile, Peter turned and seen me. I hadn't even had time to try and get my ice axe in, because it wasn't very far I'd slipped, but it was bad enough. And all I can recall was that I sort of picked myself up, took my rucksack off, checked my camera, make sure that's working, put the lens hood back on, and are you all right then, Mike? Yeah, I'm all right. And he came down. You should have seen my face, it was covered in blood. I was okay. Well, I felt okay then. So I had to help Pete down. You know, he was so shocked, you know, helping me down, holding me to go down. I think I was more steady than him until we got to the tent. We got to the bottom, ignored the skis because you could just walk across. Walked to the tent probably a quarter of a mile away from the foot. Got in the tent, and then I went. I just went, started shaking. And, of course, Pete, by that time, was... You know, we talked about things, and he decided I needed stitching up because I got a great big gash in my upper lip. And but before that, as a result of all the shaking, the shock and everything, I was suddenly, utterly and violently sick. So we had a bit of clearing up to do. stitched me up. And I think for the next 2 days, I just sat there and recovered. I was so stiff. I've never felt so stiff in my life. He had to actually help me up to actually use the pee can to hold me in position. But eventually, I recovered enough to go walking to the nearby moraine and then wander back again. And after 2 or 3 days, and incidentally, during this period, the weather had manked in. We couldn't have travelled anywhere. That was amazing. Until I felt better, and the weather got better, and off we set again. So Pete looked after me. He said on the radio that I must have had a bang on the head because I was reading a geology book. So there we are.
Radios became into their own, rather, didn't they?
Oh, yes, we had squad calls. The squad call had been introduced the previous season, and they're marvellous things about the size of your briefcase. 3 bell batteries, which you had to warm the things up in the roof, and you could talk just like being on a telephone. To base or even other parts of the peninsula, you could talk if you had the right crystals. You could hear people talking on other field areas apart from us to Halley Bay. Sometimes we couldn't even speak to the keg party who were in the eastern shacks. When we knew they were talking to base, we couldn't talk to them because it must have been in a shadow of.
I've got a couple more questions just to ask you towards the end of our hour, if I may. I know you 10 years ago you were back in the Antarctic because I was in the same cabin as you.
Yes.
The Marguerite Bay 2000 trip.
Yes, that's right.
For me, it was a trip of exploration. For you, it was a return.
It was a return.
But to a different part.
A different part.
But how did you feel about going back?
Then?
10 years ago.
10 years ago. I'm glad I went, but I didn't get the kick that I thought I might have got.
Oh, really?
I didn't get that kick.
Have you worked out why?
Yes. When you consider the appearance of the Antarctic Peninsula, it's a fjord coastline. Although we knew we were south of the Antarctic Circle, you could take that geological environment and you could go up to Norway and see exactly the same. You've got the same type of rock, possibly, in the same geological environment will create the same type of scenery. And because I'd gone down to Halley, where it was totally different, you've got no inlets, you've got in rocky inlets. What you had was ice cliffs, ice shelves, creeks. An environment was different to what you get down the Antarctic Peninsula. And although I enjoyed going down there, I went down there because I knew a lot of the history. In fact, I've been writing the story of Antarctic exploration. I'd been doing my paintings, which were illustrating some of the events taking place. And I was actually going to the places and seeing where Petermann Island was, where Charcot landed. We went to Hope Bay, where Nordenskjöld's party wintered, and we saw the actual hut which they built around their tent where they spent the winter there. So from my point of view, it was the historical association of the various bases with the stories which I'd actually written, with the idea of illustrating it with paintings, which I never actually have done. And because of that, and because the environment, the geomorphological environment, to my mind, was very similar to what you might have in other parts of the world, I didn't get the kick. You went down there because it was the Antarctic. So that's my answer.
Finally, and you haven't got to answer this one, but I was reading your eloquent account of your life after Bass, and you openly mention a couple of difficult periods in your life. One was a divorce, and one is a medical condition that you're now coping with. Is the Antarctic character building, are you drawing upon something that happened to you 40 years ago to help you cope with modern day complications?
I suppose it's difficult to not use the experience you gained. I can't honestly say, yes, I've used that bit of information there. I think it was something which has been a dominant aspect of thoughts for many, many periods, and particularly with the paintings, which I've still doing. In fact, I've brought one along, which I'll bring along tomorrow. I think more or less in every aspect, it does help. But I can't say specific that has helped there.
Did you come back the same man who went?
I think I came back with a little bit more sort of philosophical attitude towards things. If things are going to happen, then they're going to happen. And that was probably why I didn't get too upset, I suppose, that my field trip, you know. I knew that it was all a matter of accepting the conditions which were there at the time, and I just accepted it. Although I wasn't very happy, I just had to accept all that. That was the case that happened then, and I think that's probably carried us through much of my subsequent years. For better or worse, in some respects, it's a fairly fatalistic attitude to things that happen to you. And with this current problem of prostate cancer, I would rather not have it, but I've got it and I've got to live with it, and I'm taking the treatment that has been advised.
But that approach to life that you developed when things didn't go right for you in the Antarctic, and you had to the acceptance of one's position.
Well,
we have a limited amount of authority over our own destiny.
Yeah, you see, I've been in. Yeah, I think I'm just fatalistic. I think probably more fatalistic than I should be.
Before or after you went?
Afterwards.
In. Yeah,
and I've been in other desert environments. I've spent quite a long time in other parts of the world, the Sahara, for instance, and you could see from the way of the people we were living with, their environment caused them to be fairly fatalistic about things, and you can see why they probably turned towards their, you know, sort of Muhammad as their guiding light. I think it's just there's a certain character which I've got, and I think it has been determined to a certain extent by my experience down south, and I think what I'm the way I'm living now, it's still present, it's still there, still benefiting from it or otherwise.
Well, good luck.
Well, thank you.
And thank you, Mike.
Okay then, Chris.